You're watching Deprogrammed. This is the New Culture Forum show devoted to fighting back against the forces of ideological conformity, particularly among the young. My name's Harrison Pitt. I'm a senior editor at the European Conservative, and I'm thrilled to be joined this week by Connor Tomlinson, Evan's guest co-host this week, writer and presenter at thelotuseaters.com, and our special guest this week, Nigel Bigger, the Regius Professor Emeritus at the University of Oxford in Moral Theology, and author most recently of the Sunday Times bestseller, Colonialism, A Moral Reckoning. Now, one of the central points of your book, Nigel, is that the decolonization movement is working to undermine faith in the liberal international order. While this may be true at a certain level of analysis, is their main aim not really Britain itself and deculturating Britain itself? Is that international perspective warranted?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think decolonization as we have it in the UK right now, we import it from America. Black Lives Matter was the origin. In America, the narrative is that the United States is systemically racist. Mm. That's why Americans are encouraged to deconstruct the origins of the US. In this country, the narrative is that Britain is systemically racist, and we can trace the systemic racism back to our colonial history, which can be summed up in one word: slavery. Mm. So in the first instance, in this country, decolonization is an assault on on Britain as it currently is in terms of race relations, but more deeply, an assault on Britain's 400-year-long imperial record of international relations.
I see. So it's precisely because it needs to contextualize, it needs to put itself into the British context that it's forced to deal with in terms of empire rather than in terms of domestic politics, that it becomes internationalized.
You know, of course. So one reason I wrote my book, a major reason, was I don't want Britain to become prisoner to what the Jewish historian Eli Kaduri called the canker of imaginary guilt. Mm. Because if we do, if our governing elite becomes unreasonably guilty about the sins of our forefathers, then we become susceptible to political manipulation, for example, over the issue of reparations to slavery.
Indeed. And I suppose it's a common feature of revolutionaries that the best ones, the most tactically well-inclined ones, people like Robespierre or Mao Zedong, there's this understanding that in order to advance the cause of a radical transformation of society, you need to alienate a people from their own history first. You need to kind of saddle them with that canker of imaginary guilt, and then it becomes they become much more pliable to your sort of idealistic schemes.
No, absolutely. Countries like China and, and Russia, particularly China, are well versed in the arts of psychological warfare, and China is very keen to, and indeed other countries too, to manipulate Britain by making us feel guilty about things we have allegedly done in the past. So in the case of China, of course, it's the century of humiliation. Mm-hmm. Now, what the British did in Hong Kong and Canton in the 1840s was brutal and wrong, but that was a long time ago. In terms of damage done to China, Mao Zedong's great leap forward and cultural revolution have a lot more to answer for, and it's more recent.
Yes.
But of course, because that was part of the record of the Chinese Communist Party, yes, the CCP right now and President Xi are not keen to draw attention to that.
Well, one of the examples that you put in Colonialism, Moral Reckoning, that really hit a chord with me, it also hit a chord with Douglas Murray in War in the West, was the Amritsar Massacre. I mean, if that is one of the pinnacles of atrocities committed during the British Empire, for which the casualties were far lower than Mao's Great Famine or Mao's Great Leap Forward, Holocaust, the Holodomor, there was an unreserved repudiation of the actions taken by the military then. There was restitution, best there can be, paid to the families at the time. Why is it that we bear the burden of unique historical guilt emanated out from other international institutions when, for example, the Chinese are currently conducting genocides against the Uyghur people in concentration camps? It doesn't really add up to me that we are beaten with this stick of unique historical and falling for it?
No, Connor, the latter part, you know, why are we falling for it is a question we need to discuss, but no, it doesn't make sense historically. And one of the features of the decolonizing narrative is that Britain's history, Britain's colonial history and its record is taken completely out of context. Just to take the case of slavery, yes, it's true. It's true that some Britons were involved in investing in and slave trading and owning slaves and running plantations. We now regard that as abhorrent. But we have to take on board that at the time, everybody on every continent was doing slavery. And the truth is that European and British slave traders who pitched up on the coast of West Africa, they didn't raid for slaves. Mm. They sat on the coast, waited for Africans to bring other Africans whom they had raided and captured and traded them. So if we're going to talk about guilt, let's talk about the descendants of slavers and the black descendants of black slavers in West Africa. Mm. And then we have the longer trading of slaves between West Africa and the Muslim world, which was going on from about the 8th century AD, and is reckoned to have involved the transporting of 17 million slaves, which is about 5 million more than were taken across the Atlantic to the Americas.
Yeah, and I think as well, this is something that Douglas Murray brings up in his book, The War in the West. They were also summarily castrated upon arrival, so they, in many cases in the Arab world.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So it wasn't pretty. But the question you raised, Connor, about why we are so susceptible to this distorted historical narrative is a really crucial question, and I'm a bit puzzled by it. The we in this case is particularly the people who run our institutions, universities, museums, and the BBC. And I can only assume it's because most of these people read The Guardian, and if you read The Guardian, then you assume that we are indeed guilty, because this is the line The Guardian will generally push. But I think for a long time, the ground has been prepared. The idea that Britain is guilty, it can probably take it back several decades, actually. Mm-hmm.
Well, I suppose there was always within Britain at the time when we did have an empire. One only needs to think of Edmund Burke's protracted prosecution of Warren Hastings, the way in which Churchill stood on the floor of the House of Commons and condemned General Dyer for what he'd done at the Indian Amritsar massacre. There was always a critical posture towards empire within Britain at the time when we had it. And it's almost that was warranted. I'm sure you'd agree, and maybe you wouldn't agree with the Warren Hastings one, actually. But in any case,
yes.
it existed and it was present in Britain. But I suppose today that very healthy in its proper proportion, that very healthy culture of robust self-criticism has mutated into one of self-loathing, and as such, all context gets written out of the picture.
That's right. A contemporary anti-colonialist historians or decolonizers pretend that up until this point, there's been nothing but undiluted praise and adulation for the British Empire, which is complete nonsense.
Yes.
You're quite right. Not only was Edmund Burke critical of the East India Company in India, but famously J. Hobson was critical of the Boer War in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And George Orwell tells the story that during the Second World War, when news came through of the fall of Singapore to the Japanese in 1942, the English intelligentsia rejoiced.
How did the Singaporeans do under the Japanese rule? under Japanese rule? I understand, I think it was the Filipino population under Japanese rule declined by as big a proportion as the Polish one did under Nazi Germany.
Is that right?
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah. They didn't do so well.
Not all colonialisms are made in the same image.
I was going to say the same thing. It's not like when we hear about the taking of the bronzes from Benin. Mm. It's not like there was a Austin writing a Mansfield Park in Benin. There was no internal dissent against the slave trade and the various human sacrifices and the roads lined to the kingdom with the splayed corpses of men, women and children. There was nothing coming from inside that camp as there was in Britain.
No, that's right. And so, I mean, Britain's. I mean, what was obscured by the decolonizing narrative, and deliberately so for political purposes, because they wanted to focus on slavery out of context, as I say, and part of the context out of which this is abstracted. It's not only the fact that slavery was a universal institution. The other part of the context that they want to obscure is the fact that Britain was among the first states in the history of the world, along with Denmark and France, to abolish slave trading and slavery. And then Britain led the world for a century and a half, its empire for the second half of its existence, devoted considerable resources and money and lives to suppressing slavery from Brazil across Africa to India and, Australasia. Although decolonizers often complain about the way in which colonialists interfered with native cultures, and there's no doubt that the impact of modernity on Aboriginals in Australia or North American Indians was often brutal, mainly through the inadvertent importation of disease. That said, for example, the suppression of slavery, although resented by Arab slave traders and African slave traders, was rather welcomed by the poor, benighted, freed slaves.
Indeed. And one of the things you write quite movingly about in Colonialism and Moral Reckoning, particularly in relation to the so-called, I forget what they were called, not charter schools, that's the schools in Canada, what are they called?
Oh, the residential schools.
The residential schools. You write very movingly about how it was actually, the modernity, like the arrival of modernity into a pre-modern culture did have sort of a whiplash effect. And these natives themselves were pleading for their children to be given this education so that they could adapt to modernity.
No, exactly. So, I regard, what happened in the 18th, 19th centuries, there's a lot of tragedy. Because it so happened that Europe and Britain in particular had developed technologies, particularly we were capable of crossing oceans in ships. We pitched up on the coasts of Australia, New Zealand, North America, had Aboriginal Australians and Native Americans developed the technology, they would have pitched up here. But because we arrived with considerable technological superiority, and because inadvertently we brought disease, but we weren't the only peoples communicating disease. There's evidence that smallpox was brought to the Northern Territories of Australia by Indonesian fishermen, and of course, more recently, we've noticed that disease from China can travel by all sorts of means. No one intended it, as far as I know. The Chinese state didn't intend it, I don't think. These things happen.
Certainly the passengers on aeroplanes carrying it didn't intend
They didn't intend to carry it. But the impact was brutal. And you're right. Therefore, some native North Americans and Australasians and Africans realized that the world was changing and they had to adapt. And many of them did. So by the mid-19th century, native Canadians had adapted from hunting and fishing to agriculture in what's now Ontario. Their brethren on the Western Plains hadn't done so because they hadn't had to. They could hunt bison. Unfortunately, in the 1870s, the bison population collapsed, and they had to adjust pretty fast. But that, at that point, they signed treaties with Queen Victoria, which included the demand for residential schools so that their kids could learn English and agriculture and adapt. Whatever the failings of the residential school system in Canada later in the 19th century, these schools were lobbied for by native peoples, and indeed there's evidence that in as late as the 1920s, native Canadians were lobbying for residential schools in the Western provinces. And the other thing is that the schools were, until 1920, voluntary. No one was forced to go to school. And so the narrative being put about 2 years ago
In the Guardian article, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah,
there'd been some kind of genocide.
Yeah, so there were discoveries in British Columbia, I think, of subterranean disturbances in former graveyards that were alleged to be mass graves of kids from residential schools. And this was quickly, of course, broadcast by the mainstream Canadian media. New York Times, gleefully picked up by Al Jazeera, broadcast across the world. Here we are 2-3 years later, not a single body has been uncovered. There is plenty of reason to suppose that the subterranean disturbances may not have anything to do with the graves at all.
They were largely found to be rocks in most of the site that
is that right?
excavated so far. Right? Yeah, because they used the imaging and they just found bumps. They didn't actually find any bones or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So they jumped to quite a hasty conclusion based off of an ideological narrative that they a priori wanted to be true.
Mm, exactly.
That's right. So, but again, that you're quite right, Connor. So that again raises another instance of the readiness of the progressive cultural elite, particularly in the media, to pick up these horrendous stories and run with them. But then, when it turns out they weren't true, not to admit it. Mm. I'm waiting for the day when the Toronto Globe and Mail starts to broadcast to the world that they made a huge mistake.
And even when it is admitted, it will be on page 87, whereas the original story was, of course, on the front page. I suppose another potential explanation for this, because it is puzzling. Why do we seem uniquely susceptible to the sophistry,
especially in the Anglosphere?
Yes,
I think the French elite are less susceptible.
Yeah, certainly, but this is sort of the sophistry of race-based activism. I suppose it has a huge amount to do with the fact that whether we like it or not, over the last 50 years, the platinum tier of restricted truth in our society has been to do with anything around any kind of minority status. There is this sort of systematic fetishization of minorities, which is currently the culture of our woke moralistic elite. And therefore, you know, there's a fear that were we to question these claims, we would be, you know, trampling on the sensitivities of minorities and all that sort of thing.
We'd be racist.
Indeed. Yep. Yep. But it also seems likely to me that one of the explanations for the fact that this is so prevalent in a country like Britain, I mean, we talked about Japan and the Philippines earlier. I think it would be reasonable it would be foolish to blame ethnic minorities alone for this culture. That's clearly not true. There are plenty of white people in our woke moralistic elite. Nevertheless, it seems reasonable to suppose that if the Japanese had, say, opened their doors and allowed their population to become 15% Filipino, you would get more ethnocentric Filipino race-based, or in that case, ethnicity-based activism played against the Japanese host population. To what extent does the super diversity with which we're constantly told is a strength, which we now live under, to what extent it does that provide crucial conditioning factors for these kinds of narratives?
Yes, well, I think one of the explanation for the current dominance of the view that Britain is systemically racist and the decolonizing view is that in Britain, certain activist groups whose raison d'etre is racial equality and who lose their raison d'etre if it's discovered that
everything's fine.
As the Sewell Commission report demonstrated, in Britain, there are disparate outcomes for different ethnic groups. But as Sewell very healthily demonstrated, the picture in Britain is not a simplistic, cartoonish contrast between black and white, mm-hmm. with whites at the top and blacks at the bottom. First of all, there are a range of shades of non-whiteness, as indeed there are a range of shades of whiteness.
Indeed.
So we need to be more discriminate and to distinguish Chinese and Indians and East African Indians and West Africans and Caribbeans, because the evidence is the outcomes are different for different groups. And in Britain, the ethnic group that suffers most grievously in terms of outcomes are poor whites. So we have a complicated picture here, and as the Sewell Commission argued, there are a range of possible causes for these disparities, mm-hmm. of which racial prejudice is just one. Mm-hmm. So when you come across a disparity, it is not reasonable immediately to conclude this is because of racism. There could be other reasons too. In fact, Tony Stewart, I remember over 20 years ago when I lived in Leeds, he first hit the headlines when, as a young lecturer, he went public in saying that one of the causes Caribbean West Indian, young West Indian Britons not doing so well has to do with an anti-intellectual youth culture among Caribbean Britons. So he identified part of the problem as within the culture of this ethnic group. That's the truth. But there are activist groups and there are people who have made their careers on fighting racism. And I hate to be cynical, but it does seem to me that the way in which these groups, and I read responses to the Sewell report when it came out in March 21, I think. I read articles in The Guardian and the Runnymede Trust, for example. The response was so thoughtless, so knee-jerk, so immediately condemnatory, no kind of honest engagement. Mm. You have to ask yourself, what's going on here? Because if these people really cared about injustice in our society, they would really care to understand the real causes to address those. Mm. But they weren't interested.
Is it just an antibody reaction by the grievance industrial complex, fearing their gravy train might dry up? That seems to be the suggestion there.
It seems to be a strong motivation. Yes.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it's partly financial, no doubt. But it's also reputation, and people have built their identities around this. Mm-hmm. So I think that has a lot to do with why. Yes, so you've got people with a vested interest in the anti-racist movement. Many of them will be non-white, but there will be whites among them too. And then you've got a lot of other people, white people, who are terrified of appearing to be racist. I remember I took part in an online discussion a year or so ago with a church, an Anglican church body, that was concerned about profits made from slavery by a certain church fund. And on the meeting there were, I remember, I think on their side, two white people and one black man. No, three whites. And I just remember, I quarreled with the black man, and I didn't quarrel, but I made quite clear I didn't agree entirely with what he was saying. And I noticed how the other white people on the call didn't dare contradict him. Mm. And some people will exploit that. Mm. But I've been encouraged. I was encouraged last year when two books were published by non-white Britons, Tamiwa Owolade's well-titled book, This Is Not America. Because I think part of our problem is we sometimes forget we're not American, and what applies to American racial relations does not apply here. The other was Rakib Ehsan's book, Beyond Grievance, What the Left Get Wrong About Ethnic Minorities.
Yes.
But both of them effectively confirming the Sewell report's conclusions.
Yes, they both take that view. So what I think is going on, I think that there are, so obviously it goes without saying that you have whites who support this and you have ethnic minorities who support this. But I think that in general, again, only speaking generally, in general they tend to support it for different reasons. I think that the whites who support it, it's either financial, i.e. they're attached to the social status that comes with being sort of the white knight for minorities. Yeah. They want the gravy train to dry up, as Connor put it. But I do think they're also incredibly attached to all of the arcane theory that comes, that this stuff comes shrouded in. So they will read passages like, we need to systemically dismantle coloniality, and they will genuinely think that that's just brilliant. So I think that they are attached to it on a theoretical level. They genuinely believe in it.
I think it might also be a theological level.
Well, indeed, yes.
Yeah. So you mentioned Anglicanism there, and I think not only is the substitution of the conception of the British Empire been swapped out for the American Empire, as literally the world powers changed hands, but also the substitution for the egalitarianism of Christianity, that which was evangelized and aided in the alleviation of the slave trade throughout the British Empire, has been substituted for a sort of woolly liberal egalitarianism, a kind of hopeful blank slateism that anyone, if they just encounter prosperous liberalism and a liberal education, might, even the most ardent of jihadians might be able to be converted. And I wonder if that is why we're so uniquely vulnerable in the Anglosphere to subversion by bad faith actors who still abide by a sense of collective guilt. The best example of this I can think of is Julius Malema in South Africa is chanting kill the Boer, calling for white genocide, is likely to win the South African election. At the same time, the South Africans lead the charge on the International Court of Justice appeal against Israel, yeah, saying, you're practicing collective punishment.
Yeah.
It's like they're weaponizing our own standard of not wanting collective punishment against us.
This is exactly the thing. So the reason why Malema supports like radical black activism isn't because he thinks that he's got this universal moral theory which undergirds it. It's based on an unashamed partiality towards his own perceived interest as an ethnic in-group. So I think what you get is, it's basically an alliance between whites who are genuinely morally and perhaps even theologically attached to this doctrine and tribalistic, ethnocentric minority leaders. And I would even include, not on the level of Malema, but I would even include people like Sadiq Khan and Humza Yousaf in that. If you talk about the way in which, if you look at the way in which Humza Yousaf talks about the native Scottish population, if you were to substitute the word white for the word Jews for whites, it would belong in the pages of Der Stürmer.
I think there's truth in what both of you say there. I think you're right, Harrison, that many of the white people who are susceptible to the narrative of white guilt do believe it. So I was told yesterday in the gym by a fellow who is studying zoology in Oxford that apparently zoology is being decolonized because it's being said that, you know, when white Brits went out and brought back samples or animals or whatever, they were somehow stealing from native peoples, and we have to... I don't quite understand it, because my response to him was,
yeah,
the people who believe this in your university department at Oxford University are in some measure intelligent people, but this is so damn stupid. And his response was interesting. He used a German word.
What does it mean in English?
I've forgotten the second half of the German, so you're spared that. It means basically you're kind of you've got a kind of specialist myopia. So you're really bright in astrophysics and zoology and late medieval German literature, but when it comes to general moral political issues, you can be, well, partly stupid and sheep-like. And my own experience of academics has become a bit jaundiced in recent years for reasons some people may understand. But the it's true that, you know, academics are in some sense intelligent and independent thinking, but not across the board. Mm-hmm. And the operation of fear, a great sensitivity to reputation, among academics is very great, and so many of them will follow fashions, and if they don't quite agree with the fashion, they will bite their tongues and just hope it'll go away.
It's interesting you said that he was going to use a German word there. It reminded me of when Douglas, not to keep raising his spectre, but in Strange Death for Europe, he references the German term Drang nach dem Absoluten, the tendency for continental philosophy to drive towards the absolute.
Oh.
Engels wrote about this as well. He said that Germans have a radical profundity to make all totalizing structures. I think that's also something that maybe the British are weak on, the Anglosphere are weak on. It's the sort of idea that Burke puts forward, that the English are actually philosophically slow, they're not very ideological, and that they're content with their private stock of reason and inheriting traditions. We actually take people on good faith, we're quite considerate, we're quite sentimental. And so when someone actually does level a charge of discrimination against us, we do feel abhorrent towards it, unique to the other empires in history. Yeah. I mean, the Assyrians weren't exactly taking charge of racism, were they? Yeah. And they were piling skulls, so.
Right. We also have an honorable tradition of empiricism, which you would imagine might actually nip some of this in the bud fairly early on. But
You would hope.
But, and this is one of the things that I found. So I first encountered you, Professor Bigger, when I saw you, and I don't know how you put up with it, but I saw you debate some activists on the Roads Must Fall campaign in Oxford.
Yes.
And you brought some very old-fashioned weapons to the debate, facts and figures and all these sorts of things.
Yes, forgive me.
It must have become very plain to you within the first 10 minutes that these people were just not remotely interested in it. They, as Connor said earlier, they had their sort of a priori set of theoretical talking points, and they just wanted, you know, basically black, white, black good, white bad, and they just wanted, they would do anything to uphold that binary.
Yes, that's right. I did conclude quite early on that the other side were not interested in the truth about history at all, and that this was all, history was being used as a political weapon. And I have been struck over the last 6 years since I first was dragged into the colonial front and the culture wars. I have been struck by the lack of scruple. on among many in the cultural left, and this applies to academics too, which is quite shocking. But occasion in the Oxford Union when I was debating whether the road should fall or not, I observed something very significant. Initially, whenever a proponent that Rhodes should fall from his pedestal on Oxford High Street spoke, he'd be greeted with loud clapping and shouts and whistles and applause. And every time this happened, there was an eruption of applause. And if one listened, one would conclude that 95% of people in the chamber were for Rhodes to fall. But I got bored after the third time, and I stopped listening and I watched. Most people in the chamber were doing nothing. Mm. Now, the vote was in favour of Rhodes falling, but it wasn't overwhelmingly. But that taught me, actually, that what's going on here is a noisy, aggressive, threatening minority riding on the back of an uncertain, timorous majority who look around and say, well, who else is protesting? No one's protesting. I'm alone here. Mm. The truth is they're not alone, they're the majority, but because of the noise of the aggressive minority, plus the failure of institutions and institutional leadership to curb the illiberalism and the intimidation of the minority, the individuals who compose the majority feel isolated and powerless.
I see. So you have undergone a I'm sure that's true. It would be fair to say that you have undergone a change in perspective. So, like my general view on this, I'm interested in the facts, and I really enjoyed your book, and I've enjoyed other books which have dealt with empire on a sort of factual, dispassionate basis. And the particular strength of yours is that you, as a moral philosopher, you bring in forms of conceptual analysis which don't come naturally to people who are just historians as well. So it has that added benefit.
Yeah.
But so I find all of that incredibly satisfying. Nevertheless, I just don't think that this is enough to convince our opponents, because the common theme here that we're identifying is that for them, it's not as though they look through British history dispassionately and then come to the conclusion, the dispassionate conclusion, that it needs to be dismantled.
No.
It's not that they don't use our history as a justification for their schemes. They're willing to distort that history and exaggerate that history as a pretext for their schemes. It's a pretext, not a justification.
No, you're absolutely right. And you're correct that speaking the truth and trying to be reasonable is not enough. I think it's important, though, because, well, you're quite right that the committed activist has got his fingers in her ears, is not going to listen, doesn't want to listen. And if Sewell demonstrates that Britain is not systemically racist, anti-racist activists are not going to listen. They're going to shout it down because they have various interests at stake. However, because I do think a majority of people are not of that kind, they're uncertain and they're uninformed and they don't know how to counter some of the narrative that they are suspicious of or doubt. I think it's important to speak the truth, because a lot of people out there, and I think most people will listen, and it does arm them to begin to talk down, or at least at least to contradict and ignore and walk past the noisy activists.
So but, is the great success of your work to give courage to those who are either miseducated or who fear that the social costs for voicing the truth is so high at the moment that they stay silent?
Well, I certainly, the gathering of the courage to risk the social costs of countering the prevailing narrative, possession of facts and reason alone won't do that. But I do think if someone does know enough to know, for example, that the claim that Britain is systemically racist because colonialism amounted to slavery, if they know that and they know it's not true, that'll be the beginnings of, as it were, internal disturbance, and it raises the question: okay, this is not true. Am I going to pay the costs of risking saying it? You need more. You need more than a grip on the truth.
Roger Scruton famously wrote once that when asked what the role of a, well, he, I think he said it actually in a speech, when asked what the role of a conservative intellectual in public life is, he says the role of the conservative intellectual is to reassure the people that their prejudices are correct. And I suppose you probably see yourself as performing that function. Whether you would call yourself a conservative is another question, but that's the function you see yourself as performing.
I do, and I wouldn't, yeah, I mean, being conservative is a relative thing. But right now, in this cultural moment, I am certainly conservative on these matters. But I think it's really important that institutional leaders start to be aggressive and assertive in ensuring that the culture of universities is classically liberal in the sense that people are allowed to voice reasonable dissent from the decolonizing narrative or transgender ideology or the narrative that Britain is nothing but a cesspit of racism. And at the moment, particularly universities, authorities are too quiescent, but they have a responsibility to allow professors and students to voice their reasonable dissent. And if the institution provided a greater security, those who have reasonable doubts would realize that the social and professional costs of voicing dissent are becoming lower because my institution supports me.
That's interesting you thought that, too, because the general idea, it's very easy for people on the right to get incredibly frustrated with the state of our universities, and it's well warranted, it's very warranted as well, but what you seem to be saying here is that it's not as though a complete blitzkrieg of reform is necessary. All you would need to do is to tinker with the incentive structure that's currently, which currently prevails there.
I think that's right. And to be fair, in Britain, and I'm not so confident about America, I mean, different universities in different places. My own experience in Oxford has been that, I mean, early on, when I was dragged into trouble in December 2017 over my views on colonialism, I got an email from someone who worked in the Public Affairs Directorate, I think it's called. So it sounds a bit Stalinist, but anyway, that's what it's called.
The American Politburo.
So this was the university concerned with public relations, I think. And so this guy said, can we meet? I need to communicate something to you. So we did meet, and he communicated that the top of the university had my back. Because of that, attempts by some woke historians in Oxford to get the history faculty to lean on my project failed.
This is the Ethics and Empire project?
Yes, which I launched in July 2017. So all that's good, but hear this. The guy who came down from central administration to communicate the university's support insisted that we meet behind a screen in a cafe so no one could see us.
So it's still a problem. It's still a problem that conservatives need to act like homosexuals in the 1950s. It's not a sign that things are completely open if that is the case.
No. But just going back to the main point in terms of shifting the dial on incentives. I do think one of the important achievements of current conservative governments has been the passing of the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill, and then the appointment of someone to be Director for Freedom of Speech in the Office for Students, because I think that change in the legal environment, which it requires universities not just to defend but to promote free speech and academic freedom under penalty of fines, and even to expose, under certain circumstances, universities to litigation, is already making university administrators and managers think twice about. But there's a long way to go yet.
One final note, then, if we have time. I remember at NatCon, I got the opportunity to ask a question to David Starkey on a panel. I think you were sat on with him, actually.
I was.
And he was talking about the need to lean on history as a justification for the supremacy of Englishness. And I said to him, because David has said to me off camera that he thinks of himself as an almost Nietzschean, in that he is an atheist but defends parochial British culture because it is mine. And I said to him, well, the supremacy of why Britain thought of itself as entitled to go around the world and evangelise anti-slavery was that it was a Christian nation. And do we not run the risk of having our churches fall, as Nietzsche himself predicted, to being the mausoleum to a dead ideal? How do we know of ourselves then? Universities are not the only ones to declare themselves institutionally racist. The Anglican Church also has. Is it enough to just change the universities, or does there need to be something done about Britain's state religion?
I speak here as an Anglican and as an Anglican priest, so I have a dog in this fight. I think you're right. Again, the leadership, the elite in the church, the Episcopal elite, it seems to me, is just as prey to all the susceptibilities of progressive elites and other institutions. I've also heard, and I've not seen the evidence, that there is a big difference between the general opinions of the leadership in the church and the general opinions of people in the pews. I do think that the people at the top need to listen to those in the pews more, not just dismiss their views on immigration or whatever it is. But there's certainly a job of work to be done in trying to counter progressivism within the Anglican Church. And there are things, going back to another point you made, Harrison, I mean, part of what drives progressive people is, at least on the surface, a concern for the plight of previously neglected, oppressed minorities. And going back to your point, Connor, about the religious dimension of this, concern for the poor and the marginalized has been a major principle in Christianity. So that makes very good sense. But if you really want to serve the unjustly disadvantaged, then you need to get a good grip on what the causes are. It's not good enough just to assume that racism is the cause or colonialism is the cause, and therefore to support the removal of plaques commemorating Tobias Rustat in Jesus College, Cambridge, who was a major benefactor but also made some money out of the slave trade. It's not good enough to think that's the problem.
Right. I would like to ask one more question before we finish up. George Santayana once said that referring to the British Empire, never since the heroic days of ancient Greece has the world had such sweet, just, boyish masters. Having looked into this at great length, do you think that he was fundamentally correct about that?
There's a lot of truth about that. I mean, that's a bit too rosy. I mean, as my book yes. demonstrates, and I had to be honest about this, the British Empire presided over some pretty bad things. But look, folks, I mean, there's no long-standing state in the history of the world that doesn't preside over bad things. But certainly, in the 20th century, British colonial officers in India and Africa, particularly in India and in Africa, had a reputation for remarkable probity, remarkable devotion to their people. They learnt their languages, they understood them, and indeed, Brendan Gormley, who was director of an aid, I can't remember the name of it, Disasters Emergency Executive or something, 10 years ago, he made this comment. So he was in the aid business. He made this comment, and Gormley, Brendan Gormley, I presume is Irish, which is significant here. He made the comment that when you compare today's aid workers with colonial officials in terms of long-term commitment, in terms of knowledge of the local people, the colonial officials come out fighting. They were much more impressive, and he thinks that actually in future people will look back on contemporary aid workers with a lot of criticism.
Nigel Bigger, thank you for joining us. Connor, thank you very much as well for stepping in. You've been watching Deprogrammed. Make sure to like, subscribe, and leave a comment if you wish, and we shall see you on the next one.
Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.